Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper, it's Sunday, December 17th, 2017. No joy in Mudville. Giants lost.
They did all right. They were competitive.
Okay.
Now look, let me just say for the record, Eli Manning throws for 440 yards. He has no offensive line. He has no receivers. Obviously not the problem. But they'll take another loss, and they'll move up in the draft rankings for next year.
So there is that.
Yes, there is that.
Better prospects for the future.
Exactly.
All right. So, it's that holiday time of year. We got an urgent request from Zeke in California for the family latke recipe.
Yes, right.
And I immediately sent it out to him 2 hours after I got the text. And recently got a picture of the latkes, and they looked mighty fine.
All right, good. That could be Zeke's standard stock latkes picture, but we'll assume that he actually made those. That's good.
Yeah.
It's ambitious.
And in addition to that, we had a busy week. We did our holiday stroll with Granger and Nico in New York City. So that's when we get together and walk down Fifth Avenue and look at the store windows and the various decorations and have a holiday meal somewhere.
Right. It's Thursday night and it's jammed beyond belief. Beyond belief. And particularly on the street that we're walking on, which is Fifth Avenue. And, you know, the Saks Light Show, Saks Windows, Lord & Taylor Windows.
Well, we started out, we met at the King Cole Bar in the St. Regis, which is a very elegant old bar with Maxfield Parish mural on the wall of King Cole.
Right.
And, lots of wood, very kind of cozy. And that was fun and, kind of a, old school kind of start to the evening. And then we strolled down looking at a tremendous light show outside of Saks with music and the whole nine yards. I think that the windows are not the big crowd pleasers they used to be.
Well, you know that better than I. I've never been a windows aficionado.
Well, they don't even have like the crowd control devices and barriers so you have to line up anymore. So that says to me there aren't the crowds to control.
All right. Well, look, there still were plenty of people for my taste. Right. But we did make it, and we found a new restaurant.
Well, we walked all the way down. We walk from, Saks down to Lord & Taylor.
Right.
And then we head west at Lord & Taylor after looking at the windows there.
Yeah.
And we went to a favorite restaurant of Nico and Granger that happens to be called Mr. Broadway.
Yes.
And it's a kosher restaurant, which is fine because it was Hanukkah. And we had a great meal.
That's right. Mr. Broadway. It sounds almost too tacky to be believed, but the truth is the food was extremely good. It was meat-oriented for us, at least. We were getting things like the smoked brisket and pastrami and the like. And it was
pulled
great.
Pulled brisket. They also do a smoked chicken, which they were out of, so we couldn't try that.
But they also have sushi on the menu.
And Chinese food.
And Chinese food. So it really is a Jewish place.
And they have a full bar.
Yeah.
So it's a great place to go. And, very close to
Penn Station,
which was good for us because it was a gridlock alert
day.
And so I had parked at Secaucus and took the train in.
So you spent many, many days in the city this week.
Yes, we also went to the opening of Twelfth Night at Classic Stage Theater.
Right.
Downtown. And what did you think of that?
Well, I thought it was fun. First of all, Classic Stage is a very small theater on 13th Street, I'll say.
Yes, you can say that.
And we've been there several times, and they have, they do a lot of classics and some other things besides. In this case, Shakespeare. And in this case, it was in conjunction with another theater production company called Fiasco Theater.
Right.
And Fiasco Theater is, we've seen other productions of theirs too. And in particular, we saw a production of Into the Woods that they did last year on Broadway, which was fantastic. And this
really knocked your socks off.
It was as good as anything I had seen all year on Broadway. This was obviously Shakespeare, Twelfth Night, And it turns out they do primarily Shakespeare. And they've had a lot of success, success with Shakespeare. And I had a lot of fun.
And they've been working on this production for a while.
Yeah.
Tweaking it.
Mm-hmm.
They had performed it before. Not this exact production, but they had added to it, added music.
Yeah, and I think the emphasis in this production was on the humor. On the wordplay, on the humor, on the kind of, incorrigible, difficult situations that people found themselves in by virtue of nothing that they had absolutely done. And you had to sort of unwind these things and unpack them. It was played in the way that you would have thought Shakespeare comedies played years ago. It was for the laugh. And as I said, they played it with great spirit, sometimes almost over the top, honestly. But I had a very good time.
Well, the review in the New York Times,
yes.
One of the headlines for it was Twelfth Night for Beginners.
Right.
And frankly, when it comes to Shakespeare, I'm pretty much a beginner. I'm enthusiastic about Shakespeare, but not that knowledgeable,
right.
Really. And I have to say, I saw a pretty spectacular production of Twelfth Night a couple years ago with Mark Rylance in it. And it almost completely went over my head.
Did you see that?
Yes, I did see
that. Oh, I didn't remember you had seen
that. I took a group from the family.
Oh, okay.
And
you didn't get much
out
of it?
You did not want to go. You said, Shakespeare's not my thing. I'll pass.
That's right.
On this. And
was that right?
I don't know if you were right because everyone else loved it. I just, I'm enthusiastic about Shakespeare, but not
It's funny that you mentioned that because in the Times Review, I think, the Times reviewer is enthusiastic for the first half of the review and then says there have been other productions of Twelfth Night, though, that were superior. And he points out the one you're talking about, the one with Mark Rylance.
Without a doubt. Everybody thought it was superior. I'm sure it was superior. It was just I was not knowledgeable enough to enjoy it.
It's hard to know, but I do think it's a little unfair in a review to say here's one that was better because, frankly, Mark Rylance is busy. Mark Rylance is doing Farinelli and the King. It really is kind of not relevant whether he's not coming by. You know, you can't fault these folks at Fiasco for not drawing him into their own theater company.
But this was very good.
It was very good.
And a couple of the actors I really enjoyed, including one of the sort of lesser parts with Paco Tolson.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he was just terrific.
Yeah, he was extremely funny.
And then also Ben Steinfeld, who's one of the co-directors.
Right.
He played Feste, the fool.
Right.
And, he had a really wonderful voice.
You know, what's interesting, too, is, look, the truth is we got to go to the opening night party of this, and we got to meet some of these folks. And when you meet them, they're very nice young people. They're very humble. If you get a chance to shake their hands, as I did with Paco and with Ben, and say really enjoyed it, really enjoyed Into the Woods. They were very appreciative. They seemed like just very nice young people. Look, we recommend it. It's the bottom line. That's the main point. You have a chance to see this at Classic Stage. I would see it. It's a fun evening.
If you want to see an accessible production of Twelfth Night.
Good time.
Classic Stage Theater.
Yeah. And then we saw a movie last night. So we're
Shape of Water. You've been dying to see it.
I've been dying to see Shape of Water.
And I don't know how many people have said to me, I think I want to see Shape of Water. I sort of thought I didn't want to see it, but the more I read, the more I feel like I do want
to
see it.
Right. So it's a tough sell even to a guy like me who's open to all kinds of experiences. And it's a tough sell because it's a science fiction type story when you describe it in two
sentences. Well, it's a fairy tale, really.
Fairy tale. I'll go with that. And the story in two senses, without giving anything away, because I think all this is clear, is that it is a woman who is a mute, who is living a very lonely life, and through circumstances difficult to describe, finds herself encountering a sea creature who looks like the creature from the Black Lagoon. And develops a relationship with that sea creature. And that relationship.
Okay, that's over two sentences. And
is
that's
the center
enough.
Of the movie.
That's all
I'm saying.
That's
done.
Enough.
Done.
Okay.
Done.
This just goes back to my theory that great movies, don't engage you necessarily by the plot.
That's right.
Okay.
Or the subject matter.
I've been reading about this plot for a while and every single time saying no, 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 no.
Right.
And yet it is a must see.
Right.
It truly was engaging. It was beautiful.
Right.
I absolutely loved it.
It is beautiful, and it's beautiful, and I think you pointed this out immediately afterwards. It's beautiful in every scene, in even the mundane scenes, even the tinkering around the apartment, even the day at work, even the cleaning the little screens. I mean, it's a beautiful movie, and the music is great, and it just carries you away.
And the sets are extraordinary.
Right.
The two of the main characters live above a movie theater.
Right.
In these very quirky
yeah.
apartments that are just mesmerizing.
Right.
In many ways. So, you know, we have to highly recommend it. It definitely is, you know, cartoonish.
In certain aspects, it is. It's a fairy tale.
I mean, the characters are drawn broadly.
Right.
It
almost feels like a graphic novel a couple of times.
Yeah.
Which is another way of describing it. But yes, I agree with that.
Yeah. And you know, there are, you know, there's a villain. And in fact, one of the reviews says caricature describing this villain, but also perfectly plausible in his diabolical all-American normalcy. So I kind of love that, you know. He just becomes a monster in his normalcy. So that was definitely fun, worth the trip.
Right.
Encourage people, get out there, you know, set aside how you feel about people falling in love with the creatures.
The other thing I think we should mention before leaving it is that it ends with a poem. And, you know, once in a while that happens in a movie. And again, I'm not number one candidate to go with that. But I thought it was very moving.
The ending itself is just kind of lyrical. Visually, we won't tell you what that is, but visually, and then
the so-called narrator gives you this poem, and why don't you read it to us?
Unable to perceive the shape of you, I find you all around me. Your presence fills my eyes with your love. It humbles my heart, for you are everywhere. So immediately you run home and you think, well, who wrote that?
Right.
Where is it from? And there are speculations online. Guillermo del Toro doesn't even remember exactly where he got it.
Right.
But the rumors are that it might be Rumi. People feel might be Rumi. Muslim poet, scholar, theologian, Sufi mystic. We mentioned him before because there was a article in the Wall Street Journal saying Rumi might be the top
most read poet,
selling poet in America.
Right.
And it's interesting. I have a feeling they're right.
Really?
Because you know why? Today, December 17th, is like the 744th anniversary of his death.
Really?
He died on December 17th.
Oh, you're kidding?
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. There's karma. I mean, the closest Del Toro will say that he says he remembers is he got it from an Islamic bookstore. And that's so Rumi's as good a guess as any. Anyway, See the Shape of Water. So from the sublime back to the ridiculous, or what we'll call ridiculous sports. Big event this week in New York. We talked about it briefly before. Mike Frances is leaving. He's gone. He had his last show on Friday. And again, we've covered this. But the way it's been written up in the paper this week, it really confirms what we sense was likely going on. And there's a quote from a fellow named Chris Oliviero of the company that runs the radio station. And he said that, it's not entirely unwelcome in a sense because the company was increasing its focus on attracting a younger audience, perhaps by broadening the traditional definition of sports talk to include mixed martial arts and esports. And then Mr. Olivieri made the helpful observation: what you want to make sure when you make these programming changes is that you acknowledge the date on the calendar. Apparently, to Mr. Oliviero, the date on the calendar is 2018, which is a different way of interpreting the word date. But in any event, his leaving kind of coincides with what the station wanted to do, was to find a new audience and get different subject matters discussed by a younger commentator. So Frances is gone. And with him, sort of a generation of sports fans who now have no place to go.
Right. Could you just want to explain what esports are?
Yeah, so I'm...
For the uninitiated?
Yeah, I learned it myself just the other day. Esports apparently is a situation in which there's competition on video games, basically. Video game competition, which are
people
televised in a large screen.
In
like Les Paul, Madison Square Garden. And they sell tickets and they fill the place and people cheer like crazy. And it's a tournament and it's a competition. And I guess you have to be under the age of 63 to appreciate it. That's all I can say. You might not call it sports, but it's commerce. And apparently it's growing in popularity.
People watch chess tournaments, right?
Right.
Back in the day.
They do. And
did people ever watch like bridge or things like that?
I don't know. But let me just say this about watching chess tournaments. The NFL ratings are higher. So,
but in this case, the ratings are super high.
In this case, they're betting that 5 or 10 years from now, when the NFL still has issues with respect to injuries, concussions, and the like, people will be increasingly turned off and more likely to enjoy cartoon characters getting smashed up on large screens and large.
We'll see.
Yeah, we will. And won't be commenting on it? Mike Francesa. Bob Hurley also is reflecting on retirement. Bob Hurley, we may have mentioned, and I think a lot of people just know, is the former coach of St. Anthony High School, fantastic basketball program, a great man really there. And he's the former coach not because he got fired, but because the school closed. Mm-hmm. He's 70 years old. He's not really looking to travel from his home in the Jersey City area, probably not looking to start a new piece of his career as a basketball coach, and yet he can't give it up. So the article is about him sitting at He goes to basketball practices.
Okay.
He's at a basketball practice in Linden High School, and they quote, he's just watching there, and he's making notes in his book, a little notebook he keeps. This is weird, Hurley tells the coach there, a fellow named Phil Colicchio. He says, usually I'd be doing this stuff, namely coaching, but instead I'm sitting here stealing from you. But I don't know what I'm going to do with it. He's preparing for something. The muscle memory of being a coach. And the way Colicchio describes his situation is as follows. Talking about Hurley, he says, Hurley loves basketball. I coach basketball. It's two different things. And not too many people love basketball the way that Hurley loves basketball. And so the article is all about his experiences going from high school, games, practices, notebook, preparing for God knows what.
Well, he has sons that coach, right?
Yeah, and he goes to their games,
maybe he's going to give them some tips.
Sons are college coaches.
Do you think you'll find yourself, like, in the future, just randomly writing briefs because you can't stop doing it?
No, I hadn't thought about it. Some people think I write briefs randomly now. So who knows?
When you're not getting paid to do it.
That's an interesting thought. I think it's unlikely. But who knows? I wouldn't have thought Hurley would do this either.
All right, so, I mean, this is one of like a zillion articles, probably, of tips for gift giving.
Right.
But this has some interesting points. It was in the, the review section of the New York Times and written by Arthur Brooks, president of the American Enterprise Institute. And he comes up with some interesting observations, largely contributed by economists and various scientists who have studied aspects of gift giving. So we'll share some of those tips. He says here, the fundamental error here is not economic efficiency per se, but excessive usefulness. The best gifts, it turns out, are in fact useless.
That's right.
While economists are busy ruining their marriages with cash and blenders, marketing experts have long found that people get the most satisfaction from useless experiences that have emotional impact.
Yes, I will say that Tamsin made this clear to me from the beginning when she explained that an appliance is not an appropriate gift.
Right.
I have followed through on that.
But how do you give an experience? I mean, it's a little bit tricky. Mm-hmm. He really does make the point that someone will probably enjoy you taking them for a walk on the beach.
Yeah.
Definitely more than the blender.
Yeah. Well, if you get away with that, it will save you money. But
yeah,
the real point
that
is
does sound like a
something useful.
Anyway.
Useless and silly
is
okay.
He mentions that one major exception to the uselessness rule is gift giving in the form of philanthropy. As the president of a large nonprofit organization reliant entirely on donations, I can assure you that a long walk on the beach is not what your favorite charity is looking for from you. Okay. Another thing is, another realization is that regifting is not all bad.
Right.
That people actually may prize something that you cherish mm-hmm. being given to them. Right. Okay. Even though it was not purpose bought for the, you know, the current.
Right. Well, but also even but more broadly, it's got to be something nice.
Don't, if it's something you don't value, don't just, don't right. pass it on. Nobody's going to value it.
No one wants
but
garbage.
But if it's something
right.
that you value,
right.
Then chances are it will be valued by the next person. So that's okay. If you can't come up with something nice to give, yeah. at least make sure it's wrapped nicely.
That's right.
And he says that it's been proven that actually spiders wrap up food gifts to give other spiders. Well, male spiders give it to female spiders. And the females do prefer the ones with the more elaborate, they spin the silk, own silk.
They must
and the more elaborate efforts are the preferred
Did they
gifts.
Interview a lot of spiders for this, a lot of female spiders in the survey?
I think they had to observe the spiders. Uh-huh. But that's really a question for your friend, your bug friend, Harry.
Yeah. All right. Well, there you go. It's hard to argue with data like that. Yeah, I do believe that the wrapping can sell it. You know, a wrapping, it sounds like a elaborate wrapping of some kind of silly gift. It can be a lot of fun, right?
Right.
That's what we're going with this.
Okay.
But when you're wrapping, what color should the wrapping be? Well, maybe you haven't given that much thought to it, but some people have. They've thought about color in connection with the speed skating. That's right, speed skating. It turns out that there is now a rumor that the fastest color is blue. That's right. You probably didn't know that colors are different speeds. But they do.
Well, we talk about a lot of... I spend a lot of time talking about color.
Yeah.
And actually, the one thing we generally say about blue yeah. is... Well, in art, you say cool colors recede.
Yeah.
And warm colors advance. So that blue is a cool color, right? It seems to recede.
Yeah, okay. All right. So let me take you into a different realm here.
Red pops.
Yeah, okay.
So you would sort of think that red is faster.
You would think.
And yet.
So three...
In Norway.
And it's a little broader than Norway. Three leading teams, South Korea, Germany, and Norway, showed up at the last championships, all surprisingly wearing blue to skate with. In particular... Norway, which is always one of the top countries in speed skating and has always been red. And that caused a lot of inquiry as to what is going on. And this became a psychological thing as much as anything else. They interviewed several skaters. And, here's a fellow who's a sprint specialist from the Netherlands who says he heard people are now saying that blue color is faster than any other color. That's strange maybe, but I understand they tested it and it's better. And he ends up saying we in the Netherlands ought to change our suit because blue is the best color. They ask a Norwegian skater, I've heard that it skates a little faster than red, so I like to believe that. And he's skating in blue. And yet another one says, I understand it's been proven. Well, the article says basically there may not be that much to it, but there's such a thing as a psychological edge. So once you get on the ice and start doing this and spread the rumor and a little bit of science, suddenly everybody, including the other countries, are saying, how are we going to catch up with the Norwegians because we don't have the color blue?
So they're just trying to, they're trying to do whatever they can do to lower the time. The lap by like
right.
hundredths of a second.
Right.
Right. And there was the notorious fail of the American team with their Under Armour special suit that was...
Well, suits make a difference.
Okay. Suits make a difference.
But no one's ever had a theory before that the color of the suit made a difference.
Well, it's not clear here that anybody really believes that at all. When they interview the coach at the end, okay?
Well, they interview the coach at the end.
He says, first of all, he says, all I've really said is... Our new blue suit is right. faster than our old red suit.
Right.
Okay. And at the end, he does admit that the color happens to be the same color as the sort of...
The team's chief sponsor, which is a seafood company.
Yes.
Has the same color blue. Right. So, and then he smiles. So maybe, maybe that's a coincidence. Maybe it's not.
Maybe not.
But in any event, the Norwegians always ahead of the curve. Or maybe, so, and maybe blue is just faster, but you know,
seems to be the best color for the Norwegian team.
It is, but the color of the season is red, of course, and that takes us to poinsettias, Tamsin.
Well, just a little blurb about the history of poinsettias.
Poinsettias
in the New York Times, and how it was, you know, it was kind of a ubiquitous plant in Mexico. And Latin America, we saw them all over the place. One Christmas, we were in Costa Rica, and they were just everywhere. They were just like normal yard plants and house plants, you know, not special for the season, as for us. And it turned out this was all started by Joel Roberts Poinsett, the first United States diplomat to Mexico. Who observed the shrub in the early 1800s. Mm-hmm. And then he's the guy who kind of brings it to the U.S. And he ships a few to his South Carolina greenhouse, and the rest is history. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the fun thing to notice is the red petals of the poinsettia plant are not petals, actually.
Yeah.
They're just leaves. And the actual flower is that little yellow center to what we consider the flower. So, you know, it was, and the, you know, the whole red and green aspect of Christmas goes back to borrowing from Celtic traditions, etc. But it just kind of fits into that and, you know, for one reason or another has become the plant.
All right. So the biggest actual sports story this week, at least in my mind, and maybe only in my mind, is that the Brooklyn Nets, that's right, it's hard to start a sentence about popular sports stories with Brooklyn Nets, have acquired an interesting player, and it's Jahlil Okafor. And Jahlil Okafor was the number two pick in the draft in 2015, and they got him for practically nothing.
Why?
That is very interesting as to why. What happened was he was drafted by the 76ers. He had a nice first year in which he made the all-rookie team, averaged more than 15 points a game. But he plays the same position as another star on Philadelphia, Joel Embiid, who you hear quite a bit about.
Right.
He's a center in Philadelphia. And he was not compatible with Embiid as a player in their styles. And Embiid was a little more talented and was getting more time. And he drifted out of the rotation. It turns out he's something.
Okafor drifted out of the rotation.
Wasn't playing. He's an immature guy. He's a young guy, only 1 year of school, and he didn't handle it well. And
1 year of college.
1 year of college.
Okay.
20 years old, and before you know it, they were asking him to stay away from the facility.
Wow.
And the Nets get him, and they already had the third pick in the 2015 draft. And what's interesting to me about this is, and it makes the league interesting. You know, it's your situation that matters a whole heck of a lot. It's hard to believe that this guy is not talented. He must be talented. But he was in a situation that didn't work, and therefore he has no value. The Nets have a wide-open situation. He'll have value to the Nets. He may not fit the popular style in the league now, which is run and gun, because he's more of a setup center. But having said that, even styles change. So I'm looking for great things for the Nets going forward. I think it's a great pick.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. Yes, go ahead.
Go ahead?
Yes, well, you had an interesting story.
Yeah, I have a touching obituary of Hilda Eisen, who just passed away in California. She was 100 years old, a Holocaust survivor. Her entire family, she was from Poland, her entire family, I think it was in her entire family, her parents and five siblings perished in the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. She manages to escape all of that because her husband was blonde and they could fool the authorities to some extent. Mm-hmm. And they actually join up with Polish resistance and do that for several years. He dies near the end of the war. When she goes back home after the war is over, she runs into Harry Eisen, somebody she had known as a child, and they end up getting married. And here's what she says about that. I'll tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. I married out of fear. being scared to be alone in this world, no family, no friends. He had the same feeling. He didn't love me. I didn't love him. Hmm. And eventually they emigrate to the U.S. They end up in California. He finds a job cleaning meat barrels in a hot dog plant, but eventually starts his own chicken breeding business to sell eggs. She washes the eggs. He takes them out on his bicycle and sells them on street corners. By the time they sold the business in 2000, in the year 2000, it had about 450 employees and annual sales of $100 million.
Well, see, that's no small thing. I had an uncle who came over from Russia who started a chicken breeding business. And they didn't make $100 million. They made went out of business.
Well, they end up with tremendous success. They end up great philanthropists in California.
Well, obviously a very tough woman.
And one of their daughters commented, when others saw big problems, those often seemed minor to them. They always said, thank God we lived in America.
Yeah.
And so an interesting story. A long marriage, even though it wasn't based on an initial attraction.
Talk about pragmatic. I mean, that's where that leads you, right? If she's a survivor. She was a survivor. It's some story. There's an article about retail in the Wall Street Journal. People should be writing about retail.
Retail's dead, isn't it?
No, it's not dead. It's a common misconception. It's alive. It's alive in the mind of Kemper Freeman, who owns a shopping mall in Bellevue. Bellevue is an area right outside of Seattle.
Okay.
And he has some other places besides the shopping mall. And they are doing great. Great. I think you pointed out here in your own marks on the article, foot traffic is up 21% this year. Retailers are lining up to pay $100 a square foot for space in this mall.
Which is mind-boggling.
It is mind-boggling. So what's his secret? Is he on by himself? And he does some things that other malls don't do. He invests a lot more in making it an event. He has every evening.
An experience to be at the mall.
Right. So he has artificial snow coming down. He has music. He has lights. He has so and so. But so does Saks Fifth Avenue. So what's his secret and what's his insight? And he actually makes a lot of sense. He does say, first of all, we're all social animals. And people are always going to go to stores and they're going to want the store experience. Having said that, he's pragmatic about what's been going on in malls and competition from online sales. And he says, number one, there are too many malls. Mm-hmm. And he says there are twice as many malls as there are in
Canada. So we're oversaturated in terms of the malls. Stores.
So he and Canada has many more than Germany, for example. And he says he sees there's going to be a shakeout of malls and we just live with that. But having said that, even if online sales grow, they're not going to grow that much. In other words, they're 11% of purchases now.
11%?
11%.
It would seem to be like 90%.
The way people talk about it.
Yeah.
And he says, no, it's only 11%. And let's say it goes up to 20%. He says he can see that happening. That still means 80% is coming from stores. So,
and he points out the great success of some of these bricks and mortar stores. He points out especially Apple.
Apple. I think that's the best example. I agree with you entirely.
Every time I go to the Apple store, it is jam-packed.
And it is worth
thinking
about.
They are selling stuff as fast as they can.
And who has a better website than Apple?
Yeah.
And who has a set of products that are so well described in the website and on other sites? There's nothing not to know about Apple. And yet people fill that store, and that is valuable retail space. So he's onto something.
He is onto something. Okay. And he does point out Tesla's store, which sold how many? $12 million worth of cars in one day.
He has several other examples of the jewelry store, and Blue Nile,
the Amazon
Peloton,
stores are doing tremendous.
See, there are plenty of reasons for retail. You know what doesn't work, and we've observed this before, what doesn't work is to have a retail space in which there's no help, in which there's just a bunch of merchandise or people who are uninformed who are passing off as salespeople. That doesn't work, and those places are going to close.
He says he encourages at the stores that rent from him to staff it with knowledgeable, above minimum wage workers that can really add something to the shopping experience, enhance it.
Well, we saw that in She Loves Me. You saw that you needed that kind of knowledgeable salesperson, and the investment paid off.
That was the model a few years ago for Nordstrom.
And maybe so, it still is. I don't know how well they're doing or not. Yeah, but you know, the idea that there's a shakeout doesn't mean that retail is dead. That's the point.
There's a way to make it work.
Yes, there is a right way to make it work. So you had a couple points about travel, I thought.
Yes. Well, you know, we have a daughter down in the Washington area, so sometimes we have to drive in the Washington area. And, of course, it's often madness. Mm-hmm. So much traffic in and around Washington and getting south of Washington. And there's an article about Easy Pass and tolls and I-66, Route 66 down there, and that they have an HOV-type lane, which, you know, has you need to have more than one person in your car, or you have this kind of license plate that is for, it's called a green or clean license plate. So the cars like Volt, Prius, Tesla can use that lane. And recently they discontinued that. That now anybody willing to pay the toll with their Easy Pass can use that lane. People who already have those license plates are grandfathered in, but there are not going to be any new green license plates. And they, you know, people are up in arms, up in arms. You know that they are no longer going to be able to benefit from this. And yet, traffic has improved. Speeds are faster. And even though the toll for using those lanes responds to demand and the density of the traffic, so that it can, they say the price for using that lane can peak, you know, can get, go up to as much as $40.
Right.
Not necessarily. I mean, just because that's the peak doesn't mean that's the average. And that there are a lot of reasons that this may be a more efficient and effective way of doing it.
Yeah, it's a free market approach. It's going to be, by definition, more efficient and effective. But what you have is people who invested in the other vehicles, and they say they're getting the shaft here because they thought they should, by dint of having the green vehicles, they would have a pass. Now they don't.
Yeah, and what that... that was really or would be a tremendous subsidy to all those cars.
Well, yes, it was. And
so it's denying other people, right. I think, as well.
But, those cars are subsidized to begin with. I mean, I do think it just shows how difficult it is to come up with a government program that's exactly right. But in any event, a free market solution is going to work because they can adjust it. I mean, if they ended up with too much traffic, they just raise the price and they'd get traffic flow.
But still, that's interesting to me, just the Easy Pass notion of paying to use that faster lane,
sure,
that express lane, because we don't have that around here.
No, but
it's strictly how many people are in your car.
Right. Yeah.
So,
yeah. It has promise. I agree with that.
And also, for those, and I know we have listeners in the Atlanta area.
Yeah.
There was in the Wall Street Journal some mention of quirky places to go outside of Atlanta, including Passaquan in Buena Vista, Georgia, which is a 7-acre psychedelic art installation, which was recently reopened after a massive restoration. And it was built by Eddie Martin in the 1950s, who had left the family farm in Georgia for New York due to, you know, fleeing an abusive father. He says, "I built this place." He returns to Georgia after his parents die and takes over the family farm. And he says, "I built this place to have something to identify with because there's nothing I see in this society that I identify with or desire to emulate." And it's wild, and it's colorful, and it looks like it'd be great fun to see. It's about 2 miles southwest, 2 hours, rather, southwest of Atlanta. So that would be fun. And another one built in the 70s by Howard Finster is Paradise Garden in Somerville, Georgia. And that's on the north side, about an hour and a half outside of Georgia, on the northwest side of Atlanta. And it has all kinds of bizarre constructions out of found objects, Coke bottles, crazy things, not colorful like Passaquan, but really kind of great creativity and imagination going into crazy structures. So that would be two fun places, two fun field trips within a couple of hours of Atlanta.
Okay. And there was one odd article, we'll just pause on for a moment, the strange wisdom of the third person, reflecting on the fact that people who normally refer themselves in the third person are often dismissed as on the path to celebrity rehab. But in fact,
including Donald Trump,
LeBron, and others.
Right.
But the article makes the point that
Elmo.
In Buddhism, one wouldn't think of it that way, that there's a Buddhist tenet that if you think of yourself in third person, you probably will have an insight into how you might behave in the future. And this gets a little complex for me at least. The idea basically is that the thing you think of as you, the entity whose well-being occupies your every waking thought, is an illusion. So I can't do much with that, but what it's really saying is if you start describing yourself to yourself in the third person, you can see your actions more objectively. You know, Dan is doing this, Dan is doing that, Dan is behaving this way, Dan is behaving that way. And by stepping outside,
it allows
of yourself,
you to step outside yourself.
You critically
and look
evaluate
at yourself, yeah.
what you're doing.
That you are not those thoughts, you are not those
right.
feelings.
So there you go. Yeah. So everyone out there who thinks they're on their way, or everyone who you think might be going to celebrity rehab, is really on their way to salvation, Buddhist style. And this person actually says, and it's a fellow named Ben Dolnick, that he finds it's a great relief to think of himself in the third person. He takes a little break from his identifying so closely with his own fortunes, and he feels that he's a better person as the result. And then at the end, he asks himself, is that why Donald Trump's doing it? And his last line is, well, Ben doesn't think so. So,
all right, Tamson thinks we ought to move on.
All right. So we wanted to close with a thought of a holiday movie, but an unusual holiday movie.
We all have our favorite holiday movies.
We do.
And they're all the typical
the
ones,
usual
right?
suspects.
Yeah.
You know, It's a Wonderful Life, etc.
Love Actually.
Yeah, that's true. But anyway,
Christmas in Connecticut.
Okay, now we got you going. But the Times has an apt observation. I give them props for this. There's an op-ed piece, I might add, which says that, you know what's a great holiday movie? Harvey. And Harvey is the movie in which Jimmy Stewart plays a character who's slightly off. He's in a Midwestern town, he drinks a little bit, and he has an imaginary friend. And his imaginary friend is a 6-foot rabbit, although as he likes to explain, is really a puka, which is a spirit in the form of a rabbit. And there's no great animation technology in the movie. It's Jimmy Stewart looking at what appears to be a coat rack or a wall or another person and speaking to a large rabbit. And he keeps this up the entire film.
Yeah, I mean, his family keeps trying to commit him, and they aren't really able to because everybody's so charmed by Jimmy Stewart and his Harvey.
He is, and we saw a production on Broadway with Jim Parsons in the Jimmy Stewart role. It was a wonderful play. It was even better as a play.
Yes.
Not anything wrong with Jimmy Stewart, but a play has always come across just a little bit more.
I saw this 100 years ago,
yeah.
growing up at a local community theater production by the Kensington Garrett Players,
yeah.
and in the Kensington Armory.
Yeah.
And it was charming then. It was charming with Jim Parsons. It's a charming movie.
And the question is, why is it a holiday movie? And the person who writes the article...
Well, Jennifer Boylan.
Makes a good case. That
if the holiday season means anything at all, it's about believing in things we cannot actually see. That virtues as shopworn as faith, hope, and love can abide even if others think you're a crazy person for believing in them.
And that...
Seems like a great thesis for
a holiday movie. And to give you a sense, we'll just close with this. Here's just an excerpt from one of the speeches that Jimmy Stewart gives in talking about Harvey and their experiences. He says, Harvey and I warm ourselves in golden moments. We enter bars as strangers and soon we have friends. They tell us about the big terrible things they've done and the big wonderful things they'll do. Their hopes and their regrets and their loves and their hates, all very large. Because nobody ever brings anything small into a bar. And then I introduce them to Harvey, and he's bigger and he's grander than anything they offer me. And when they leave impressed. Well, thanks very much. We probably won't speak to you again through this medium before Christmas. And have a Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.